What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
America Trends. Today, John, we are going to be talking about something that everybody is talking about and praying that it doesn't have an impact on them that is going to mean the loss of their job or the necessity for their own life. I'm talking about artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's a scary
world. Now, John, don't
roll
your eyes. I mean, because there are people out there, oh, do I have to hear more about this AI? I don't even understand it. I don't know if it's ever going to come in my lifetime. Well, trust me, you need to understand it, and it is coming in your lifetime. Just ask Alexa.
Oh, that's
or
right.
Siri.
Alexa. Oh, my goodness.
Have you been reading about Alexa not even responding to commands and just starting her own conversation in people's homes? Have you seen that?
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, she's just really taken off on her own. So it's pretty remarkable stuff, but you have to think about all the gadgets that you now have in the technologies, and there's a lot of AI built into every one of them.
Yes, there is.
And it's not going to stop.
And they're all listening, and they're all learning.
That's right, and they're getting smarter and smarter. Well, think about it this way, John. We don't have eyes in the back of our head. So therefore, we don't have eyes on the side of our head. Therefore, a car with all those sensors probably is going to be able to avoid some of the situations that human beings can. So maybe the machines can do certain things once well programmed that we're just unable as human beings to do.
I think the car technology is wonderful because it should lower our insurance because, you know, once that technology is in there, and I know your car has it, you're not going to be able to hit people from behind, which is the biggest accident that we have. So some AI is good. I mean, this is driver assist. I like, you know, I think we need it in the trains. We've been dragging our feet. We've been talking about it for years. But, you know, it kind of scares me, the driverless car and some of this other stuff they're talking about, driverless trucks. And I don't know, that just...
Well, John, just to put it in perspective for you, there was a recent Associated Press story, and this is the thoughts of the Google CEO today. And he said that artificial intelligence fueled by powerful computers is more important to humanity, now listen to this, than fire or electricity. And then he goes on to explain how he's having trouble with his employee base, but that's a whole other story. But he goes on to suggest that this will be so revolutionary. Now, I know there are some really deep thinkers of the modern era who've been trying to avoid the possibility that AI is going to be as dominant and pervasive as it is. Bill Gates, and then the brilliant Dr. Stephen Hawking, whom we just lost.
Yep, yep.
And what a loss that was, John.
Brilliant guy. I tell you, brilliant thinker.
And living within the limits of his own body since he was 21 years of age, told that he would not live and survive to a healthy old age to contribute all that he did. And yet he was able to live until 76.
Incredible.
Remarkable. So our guest today, Amir Hussain, is the author of The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. Now, John, you know this. He is not among all the skeptics.
No, he is not. Not at all.
And in fact, I mean, he paints us a picture of AI taking center stage and having profound impacts on the human condition. But John, he sees them as being generally positive and ameliorative, that they are going to be very, very useful adjuncts to the human condition.
Yeah, I don't know. With all good technology, there's the people who want to use it otherwise. And if you got super machines that have super strength or whatever, you know, that part is kind of scares me.
Well, he does talk about the military and the various uses for it. Could we have a war without human beings? So if we're not spilling blood, then what is the impact overall? And we must remind ourselves, John, that if this isn't as significant and serious as I'm saying it is, based on this conversation with Amir Hussain, then why is China And they're very smart in terms of how they plan for the future. Why are they looking at AI and saying by 2030, they are going to be the leaders in the world in this area, and they feel that will give them a competitive advantage that America is going to be hard-pressed to make up?
Yeah, oh, I agree. This is definitely something that you got to have your eye on, and we should be working toward, because if we don't, somebody else is going to do it. And like I said, you know, it can be used for good as well as bad. So,
and, you know, this Dr. Hussein, who we have on the program, he does think it will take longer than 2 decades, which is what many people project as the realistic time frame to become a dominant force in our society. And even today, we see the proliferation of machines of all types using what he calls artificial narrow intelligence. But it's going to be taking a longer period to bring into view artificial general intelligence. And we get into all of this. So, Alexa, Siri, Watson, listen up so you can understand your future assignments right here on America Trends. Amir Hussein, let's begin our conversation today with a definition. What is the sentient machine? Of course, the term that I'm looking for is sentient.
Sure. So, you know, there's a number of definitions there, but the idea behind sentience is really, in some sense, self-awareness. The idea is that things are more intelligent as they're able to aspire to a grander goal. So you might have, for example, animals, bacteria, living things, organisms that have very simple goals, just to be able to survive, to be able to find food. And most of us would say that, well, a chimpanzee that can do, you know, higher goal setting than, say, bacteria is more intelligent, and a human being that can have even higher aspirations and even higher goals is more intelligent than a chimpanzee. In that same sense, sentience is this idea that you are able to aspire to great goals and you have a self-awareness associated with that.
So separate humans from those machines that we think are going to be smarter than us, and take away some of that which we, you know, pride ourselves as being top of the chain in doing. And will they develop this sentience?
Is it possible for a machine to be self-aware? What does self-awareness really mean? There's an entire area, philosophers, for example, have pondered this for a while. And the idea, of course, is that all of these things are essentially subjective experiences. I can attempt to narrate these to you, but your subjective experience, exactly the way you experience it, is not something that I can completely relate to. The book, in fact, goes into some of this, the thinking of Descartes, for example, where mm-hmm. he said, I think, therefore I am, which is that the ultimate existence proof for a philosopher is that there is some emanation of thought, and the fact that that thought exists and I sense that means that there must be a me from which that thought arises. So those are, of course, subjective constructs. But then some have said the question of whether a machine can think is about as interesting as whether a submarine can swim. The point there is that ultimately the subjective experience is one part of it, but really what matters is what can the machine do? And that's really where artificial intelligence is beginning to take off in this domain of artificial narrow intelligence, where these systems can do specific tasks very well, better than humans can in that domain. And ultimately, for our economy, for improving our lives, for solving big problems, that matters a lot.
Why is it then so many bright people over the recent period, whether it's Stephen Hawking or whether it's Bill Gates or others, have concerns about artificial intelligence? Some of them are changing some of their impressions of all of this. But on balance, tell us what you think we should be feeling about the onset of more artificially intelligent machines, if you will.
Well, first of all, I can't dismiss or diminish anyone's concerns. Of course, these people are, as you mentioned, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, very intelligent people, and their concerns are not unfounded. But I will say one thing. I think that the concerns are, as reported in the press, quite overstated in a couple of very important ways. First of all, we are not at the cusp of artificial general intelligence, or in other words, a system that can have human-level capability and isn't just able to master one skill, such as driving a car or recognizing images, but rather all skills like human beings can. You know, we can learn how to play the piano and we can ride a horse and we can also run a business. These are very different skills, but yet human intelligence is unique in its ability to be able to do these things generally. So we are not at the cusp of artificial general intelligence. In specific areas, AI has exceeded human capability. For example, it can beat humans at the game of Go. It can beat humans at the game of chess. It can recognize handwriting better than human beings. It can drive a car perhaps more safely. But if you took the self-driving car AI and asked it to play a game of Go, it wouldn't be able to. Now, the fact that we have time, the fact that AGI is not around the corner, is not imminent, means that we have the opportunity to invest in areas of safe AI research and explainable AI research, algorithms and techniques and frameworks that can ensure that by the time this technology matures and we get to a higher level of capability, that we also have some of the underlying safety and the explainability constructs that we'll need. So that's one aspect of it. And just very briefly, the other part of it, which is, I suppose, a little bit more philosophical, is simply this, that the fact that machines can do a task better than we can, that they perform an economic labor more effectively and more efficiently than we can, doesn't diminish us. Because even though we still like to call ourselves by, you know, the last names that represent our Asian trades, porter and farmer and goldsmith, the reality is that intrinsically, humanity is not tied up in our ability to perform an economic labor. We are more than that. And therefore, if machines can perform these economic labors, if machines too can come up with ideas, that doesn't mean that that makes us less human. The question is, what is human?
You suggest that we have time, and yet in the book you talk about moving from ANI to AGI, a journey towards sentience, to be a generalist like a human. Is that possible? Well, I would imagine just about anything's possible going forward, but tell us where we are on that continuum from what is ANI to AGI and explain that to us.
Absolutely. So first of all, is it possible? Well, the first question that you need to really concern yourself with is there any law of physics, some fundamental scientific principle that we know of that tells us that it is impossible to build a machine that is, a generalist, that is a general intelligence? And I'm not aware of any such law. It appears that there is nothing within the realm of physics and known science that prevents us from doing this. So therefore, I think it is possible. The second question is, well, practically, where are we on that continuum and how much more work do we have to do? My view is that we have a few decades of additional work to do in order to get to, truly general intelligence. You know, it could be 20 years, it could be 30 years. There are several surveys and polls of many AI researchers, dozens and dozens of AI researchers across the world. And in general, you'll find that their answers range from anywhere from, 10 to 15 years on the low end to 60 to 70 years on the higher end. Most of them do seem to feel that this is possible to do. Now, what's the practical difference between a decade or six decades? To me, not very much, because of two reasons. One, in the scale of human history, what is 10 versus 60 years? It's just a, drop in the bucket. And secondly, along the way, we will be making progress. These systems will be getting smarter. So in the near term, we should probably concern ourselves not with the question, will these machines suddenly come alive and become sentient and take over the world like, Skynet from the Terminator movie, but rather, what happens when these machines are capable enough to perform sufficient economic labor to where even advanced developed societies could see 15, 20, 30% unemployment? What are we doing to account for the changes that some of this automation might drive? So there's a continuum both of capability development, but also a continuum of policy development that needs to be addressed in parallel.
Oh, absolutely. You tell us that a lot of movement in AI should be apparent to all of us because we are living side by side or within our cars or many robotic machines that are helping us to do lots of things already today. You say this is happening in astronomy, chemistry, materials science, manufacturing, financial services, and the list goes on. And yet your introduction to some extent in all of this, aside from your great academic background, was the fact that you went into the healthcare system because of something called cluster headaches. And you say medical science is a little bit behind in this, but you talk about the potential it might have for helping people who have rare conditions like that.
Absolutely. So I suffer from a condition called cluster headaches. And even though it's a terrible condition, I mean, it's about the most painful thing that you can possibly experience. The level of pain is usually such when you're having one of these attacks that most people pass out. And colloquially, these are referred to as suicide headaches. The headache itself doesn't kill you unless you choose to. So it's a pretty dark place to be in. That being said, we don't quite know what a cluster headache is. And, you know, I think just the name of the condition, headache, most people look at that and say, well, it's just probably a bad headache. It's actually considerably worse than a bad headache. However, because we don't quite know what it is, and also because not enough people suffer from this to have the kind of top-end research directed at uncovering this problem, it really is more of a bucket illness. I mean, it could be that what we complain about are the symptoms and the causes of these headaches could be different conditions or illnesses. We just don't know. So the treatment is it's sort of you have a hammer and so you strike, you know, at the nail. It's really not very finely tuned, if you will. The reason that happens, again, is fundamentally an economic reason. There aren't enough people suffering from the condition for us to prioritize our medical research talent towards what I call these long tail illnesses. You know, there's lots of illnesses that small numbers of people suffer from and they don't get all the attention. Artificial intelligence can help in these areas by capturing data and automatically analyzing data and proposing potential correlations and reasons why something happens and bringing that to the fore, automating the reading of case reports, medical reports, patient reports, bringing that to the fore so that a smaller number of human researchers can look at much larger quantities of data and draw conclusions as to what might be causing these, even perhaps generate hypotheses automatically. So I feel that is a huge potential benefit, and particularly for sufferers of these bucket illnesses, these undiagnosed symptoms that could be the result of many different conditions, these long tail illnesses, that they can benefit. My hope is that I am able to contribute to the solution of my own condition, but let's see.
Is that why you say, although some people have their greatest fear that AI will render us completely useless, that it may be really the fount of our survival long term?
Well, yes, it has a big, I think that has a big role to play. There's two things. One is that if you think about the human condition, right, we can romanticize it, but the reality is that many of us still live in squalor. Many of us still live in conditions of suffering. There is a lot of negativity in the world. There is illness. There is hunger. And there is a lot more to aspire to. My dedication in the beginning of the book relates to, a wish for the children of tomorrow that they may elevate the human condition. And I mean that sincerely. I think that the biggest contribution we can make is via science, is via the ability to equip our children, our coming generations, with the tools that they can use to uplift the human condition. So that's one aspect of it. I'm a believer in science. I'm a believer in technology. I'm a believer in the power of these tools to improve our lot. The other aspect, of course, is that I also believe in the capability of the human mind, and all of the wonder around us is a product of our mental prowess. These skyscrapers, these bridges, these flying aircraft that hurtle through the sky, quantum computers and space travel. This is all a consequence of the human mind. So we are here to know we are here to learn, and we are here to invent what is next. And in that, artificial intelligence is such a seminal step. It is where we cross the line from producing just machines that mimic the human muscle to machines that mimic the mental muscle. And I think that really is, in many ways, a final contribution that we can make to the future.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can
us,
direct
we
message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
Well, you certainly impressed me when you talked about machines that can explore more options more quickly, let's say in the mathematical space, than we ever could, because we as humans are constrained, as you remind us, in terms of the energy we have, the physical space available to it, and we have always adapted through our evolutionary cleverness. But here we can empower, if we can control, this artificial intelligence to give us so many more options than we, constrained as we are, can provide ourselves.
Absolutely. You know, as fabulous as the human mind is, it has to operate under some physical constraints. It has to be contained by our skull. You know, the cranium is only so large, and it can only consume about, estimates suggest, 20 watts of power. So the way that it is able to make so much of those, you know, minimal resources is by this technique that's called pruning. The idea is that you don't consider all possibilities. You get sort of rapidly into this templatized thinking. And what we call common sense, for example, is essentially a way to not consider a lot of things that don't seem commonsensical. Because in our past experience, those possibilities can effectively be excluded. And after all, in excluding them in the past, have we not survived? Have we not thrived? We have. So therefore, the brain says, okay, well, you don't need to consider them. Now, the reality is that we didn't evolve to solve, equations of string theory or write machine learning code in some high-level programming language. We evolved to run from the tiger, hide from the bear, and feed ourselves and our children and survive to the next generation. So for a lot of these other cognitive tasks, perhaps the pruning that we are able to do very effectively, and that is a biological construct, that pruning might not be the best way to think through some of these higher cognitive challenges. And that's where machines can come in. I mean, for example, this recent case where an artificial intelligence application beat the human grandmaster at Go, the move that AI program took was something that all commentators, the grandmaster that was being competed with, were all just awestruck by. And why was that? Because in collective human experience, in thousands of years of mankind playing the game of Go, a counterintuitive move like that had not been contemplated. Think about that. 2,000 years of human experience didn't result in that counterintuitive idea that an AI within days, weeks, hours of training was able to generate. That's the power of being able to apply counterintuitive thought and not prune the way that a human brain does.
Very interesting. You remind us that fully sentient machines, while they're not here, but they are closer due to a learning technique that you call deep learning. Explain that.
So deep learning is essentially a type of machine learning, and I defined, you know, artificial intelligence earlier as this branch of computer science that is concerned with smart programs, building smart machines that can solve problems that previously required human intellect. Now, that's a general area. Within artificial intelligence, there's machine learning, which is concerned with techniques that can learn from data. And within machine learning, there is this area called deep learning. Deep learning is influenced by the way the human brain works. So the human brain is a network of billions and billions of neurons that take in inputs and then, based on what they recognize that input to be, either are activated or not. So you have this network of billions of neurons all firing simultaneously that then result in decisions being made. Deep learning is an abstraction of that in code, where we build networks of simulated neurons, hundreds of thousands of these neurons, millions of these neurons, and we send inputs, such as, for example, inputs from a camera where you are looking at a picture, and the neural network is then trained to discover within that image, say, the outline of a dog versus a cat, or where a human being might be in that image. And that process of teaching the network, of feeding it all this data and then telling it when it's right and when it's wrong, just by giving it that feedback, it allows the network to learn. That deep learning methodology is what has resulted in so much success now recently with AI. When you interact with Google and you put in an image and ask Google to look for similar images, it's using deep learning. When you speak with most voice recognition systems, you just converse in natural language and they listen to the audio and can transcribe that as text. That's a deep network taking those inputs with all those virtual neurons firing and creating a decision in the end. The key thing to remember about this is that with all machine learning techniques and also with deep learning, you are not telling the program, you're not telling the network exactly what to do. You're not saying, if input is A, then say B. You're just giving it examples. And by feeding those examples and telling it when its prediction is right or wrong, that act itself, that giving of examples, is what is causing the network to learn. And that's fundamentally different from how code has been written traditionally.
Help us to understand, with the automated cars that are coming online, what is it that they have to understand that we have taken a long time, since most of us were 15 or 16, to learn about the road? What is it that they are able to do? Because we respond to so many different situations when we're driving. How will that machine perform these various functions that we have acquired in terms of our experiences over many years?
Well, a few things to think about there. First of all, with these cars, one aspect of what will make them very effective is the fact that they can have an abundance of sensors. And when a human driver is focused on the road, we have limited attention and we have limited sensors. We have two eyes that are basically focused in front of us, and we look at the rearview mirror. We aren't really looking elsewhere. So both attention and the number of sensors is limited. One of the luxuries that these electronic systems will have is that they can have not just cameras in the front and the back and on the sides, but they can also have LIDAR, you know, laser distance assessment. They can have technology that can see through fog, infrared to pick up heat when you can't see an object. So the amount of data coming in is going to be a lot more effective than what a human being is able to process, number one. Number two, once that data comes in, a collection of these deep learning networks are being used to identify and sift exactly what that data is suggesting. So not only is the object detection, for example, where are the lane markers on this road? Is that a deer attempting to cross in front of me? All those sorts of things, as far as detecting objects, is what we're training these neural networks to do. And Google and Waymo and many others have driven millions of miles on roads, capturing that data feed and training these networks over time. And the last element of this is not just the sensors and not just making sense of the data, but then actually acting. In this situation, what do I do? Do I go forward? Do I go backward? Do I turn left? And so on and so forth. And that is being done in two ways. One, there are some overarching rules. For example, if there's an obstruction, don't smack the car into it. If you detect an obstruction, you know, stop. So that's a specified rule. But then there are many other situations. For example, exactly how do I shift from this lane to the other lane, given the current situation in front of me? And that's something that, again, we can train these networks to do. Where these networks are very powerful is in generalizing examples. So you show them 15 situations, and then you ask them to act in a 16th situation, the likes of which they have not exactly seen before. These systems are able to generalize and are able to figure out an effective action in that 16th situation. And that's really the power of moving beyond if-then-else rules and into this world of machine learning.
You tell us that new developments in virtual reality, lenses, headsets, sensors, AI-based perception, and control algorithms can endow us, humans, with far more superhuman strengths. Explain that to us.
Yes, and that's something that, you know, in some degree happens today. For example, if you're the pilot in an F-35 fighter, one of the most sophisticated pieces of equipment that you use is actually the helmet that's on your head. And this helmet is kind of magical. It lets you see through the aircraft. It lets you interface with sensors that are on the outer skin of the aircraft, optical systems, and so on and so forth. It gives you a view that you could not develop with your own human eyes. So that's an example of where sensory data is being broadcast into your helmet, you know, visor, and is giving you capabilities that you couldn't see in infrared, but now through this you can. You couldn't see behind you, but now through this you can, and so on. But now where artificial intelligence comes in is where some of that data from a huge number of such sensors can also be enhanced. And you don't just get the raw feed, but the AI is processing all of this data and is telling you what matters. For example, going back to our F-35 fighter pilot, it's not just here's a view all around you, but it's I think that there is a stealth aircraft approaching so far away behind you that has not been picked up by radar, but one of the optical imagery systems has picked it up, and the AI has detected that that object is of type such and such, some enemy fighter. Mm-hmm. And these are its capabilities. And because these are its capabilities, I would recommend that you take this action. And by the way, I've queued up this action. Should I take it? That's the kind of synergy, and that's the kind of collective power that these next generation sensors, these new visualization capabilities with augmented reality, et cetera, and AI can all enable together.
Amir Hussain is with us, the sentient machine. And you do spend a good bit of time on warfare and AI, and we don't have a lot of time left, but I do want you to be able to make the argument as to where AI is going to bring us as it relates to modern and unimagined warfare of the future, and give us just a sense of that, and what are the philosophical implications of, Terminator-like activity if people think back to those motion pictures.
Well, recently, Vladimir Putin said that he who controls AI will control the world. And those are, again, ominous words. But if you think about the thrust of the argument, it makes a lot of sense. With General John Allen, who was our commander of the ISAF and ran all three of our wars in the Middle East, I've done a lot of work with him on this concept of hyperwar, this idea of AI coming to the battlefield. Now, the question is, why would anybody want that? And the answer is that, it's inevitable. There is just no way to guarantee that others will not work on technology like this. And there is no ability for us to just say, here's a blanket ban and we wish for no one to work on this and then expect that everyone in the world will comply. That's not going to happen. So as scientists, we're focused on developing the framework and the safety capabilities that if these things were to happen, what are some of the design elements of a safe AI, of an explainable AI? The speed at which the future war will unravel is unthinkable. And the reason why it will be accelerated is because decision making, even in tactical context initially, will be offloaded to synthetic systems. Whereas previously you had men in the loop all over the place, very soon adversaries and we ourselves will discover that we can really tighten our response by removing some of those latencies, by removing some of those people that were in the loop. And if that gives an adversary an advantage, the rational expectation is that they would go in that direction. And if they go in that direction, how will we respond and what do we need to prepare for? Those are the kinds of questions that we contemplate as we look at the applications of artificial intelligence in future war or this hyper-war concept.
And what are the implications of that? I mean, are we more likely to use this if, in fact, we are not immediately imperiling individuals, but systems fighting one another? What's the likelihood here? How much have we role-played what this might mean to the future of warfare?
Well, one thing to say, of course, is that technology is neither good nor evil. Technology is agnostic. And so, unfortunately, we don't require technology to give us a supply of malevolence. We have plenty of that here on planet Earth amongst human beings. All advanced technologies are used by good people and bad people, and that, I think, will continue even with artificial intelligence. The fact that you have automated weapon systems, does that make war more likely? Mm-hmm. I think it's not the automated weapon systems that will make war more likely. It's imbalances that make war more likely. When one party feels that they have a freedom of action that the other party cannot counter and that they can get away with something, there is an imbalance. In those conditions, you see that disparity breeds conflict. And that's one of the things that we are focused on, and we want to avoid that. When China has stated that by the year 2030, they will dominate AI, and they're spending $150 billion in government funds in developing those capabilities, when Mr. Putin says that he knows that he who controls AI will control the world, in that context, we cannot allow disparities. And in fact, our view and our hope is that deterrence will actually prevent conflict and outbreaks, and that's really the direction.
Well, if you're going to read this book, make certain you pay special attention to Chapter 4, page 87, Warfare and AI, important to all of us. But this book overall is so important. The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence, Amir Hussain, thank you so much for this revealing look at AI. I think it's been great for me and for our audience. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you.